greater volumes, but the notes were whipped away by the wind the second they left the instruments. With half an hour to spare, Benedict Fenwick had turned up with the clothes on his back and an overnight bag stuffed full of clinking map-making equipment. The captain, once again the unflappable Admiral Lacker, assigned him the last available quarters. Elliot walked out onto the dock with Quentin to see him off.
"So," he said.
"So." They stood together at the foot of the gangplank.
"You're really doing this?"
"Did you think I was bluffing?"
"A little bit, yes," Elliot said. "Say goodbye to Julia for me. Don't forget what I told you about her."
Julia had already stowed herself in her cabin with the air of someone who wasn't planning to re-emerge till they'd made landfall. "I will. You'll be all right without us?"
"Better off."
"If you figure out what happened to Jollibee," Quentin said, "go ahead and kick the ass of whoever's responsible. Don't wait up for me."
"Thanks.
For what it's worth, I don't think it was the Fenwicks. I think they just think we're dicks." Quentin remembered the first time they'd met, how odd Elliot's twisted jaw had looked. Now it was so familiar he didn't notice it. It looked like something natural, like a humpback whale's jaw.
"I suppose I could make a speech," Elliot said, "but nobody would hear it."
"I'll just act like you're exhorting me to further the interests of the Falorian people and show these renegade outer islanders, who probably just forgot to pay their taxes, if they even have anything to pay taxes on or with, that we stand for everything that is just and true, and they'd do well to remember it."
"You're actually looking forward to this, aren't you?"
"If you want the truth, it's taking all my self-control just to stay standing here on the dock."
"All right," Elliot said. "Go."
"Oh, you've got an extra crew member. I forgot to tell you. The talking animals sent someone."
"What? Who?"
"Exactly. Who or what, I never know which. It's already on board. Sorry, it was politically expedient."
"You could have asked me."
"I would have, but I thought you might say no."
"I miss you already. See you in a week."
Light on his feet, Quentin jogged up the plank, which was hastily withdrawn behind him as soon as he was on deck. Incomprehensible naval yells issued from all quarters. Quentin did his best to stay out of people's way as he picked his way back to the poop deck. The ship creaked and shifted slowly, ponderously, as it leaned and bore away from the wharf. The world around them, which had been fixed in place, became loose and mobile. As they cleared the harbor, the world changed again. The air cooled, and the wind picked up, and the water abruptly became gunmetal gray and ruffled. Massive swells came booming through underneath them. The Muntjac's enormous sails caught hold of the wind. New wood cracked and settled comfortably into the strain. Quentin walked to the very stern and looked out over the wake, swept clean and crushed into foam by the weight of their passage. He felt good and right here. He patted the Muntjac's worn old taffrail. Unlike most things and most people in Fillory, the Muntjac needed Quentin, and Quentin hadn't let her down. He stood up straighter. Something heavy and invisible had relaxed its taloned grip, left its familiar perch on his shoulders, and winged away on the stiff breeze. Let it weigh down somebody else for a while, he thought. Probably it would be waiting for him when he got home again, but for now it could wait. When he turned around to go below, Julia was standing right behind him. He hadn't heard her. The wind had caught her black hair and was whipping it wildly around her face. She looked outrageously beautiful. It might have been a trick of the light, but her skin had a silvery, unearthly quality, as if it would shock him if he touched it. If they were ever going to fall in love with each other, it was going to happen on this ship. They watched together as White Spire grew smaller behind them, and was finally obscured by the point. She'd come here all the way from Brooklyn, just like him, he thought. She was probably the only person in the world, in any world who understood exactly what all this felt like to him. "Not bad, right, Jules?" he said. He breathed in the cold sea air. "I mean, this whole trip is ridiculous, basically, but look." He gestured at everything. The ship, the wind, the sky, the seascape, the two of them. "We should have done this ages ago." Julia's expression didn't change. Her eyes had never gone back to normal after the incident in the forest. They were still black, and they looked strange and ancient with her girlish freckles.
"I did not even notice we were moving," she said.
Chapter 4 You have to go back to the beginning, to that freezing, miserable afternoon in Brooklyn when Quentin took the break bills exam, to understand what happened to Julia. Because Julia took the break bills exam that day, too. And after she took it, she lost 3 years of her life. Her story started the same day Quentin's did, but it was a very different kind of story. On that day, the day he and James and Julia walked along Fifth Avenue together on the way to the boys' Princeton interviews, Quentin's life had split wide open. Julia's life hadn't, but it did develop a crack. It was a hairline crack at first. Nothing much to look at it. It was cracked, but you could still use it. It was still good. No point in throwing her life away. It was a perfectly fine life. Or no, it wasn't fine, but it worked for a while. She'd said goodbye to James and Quentin in front of the brick house. They'd gone in. She'd walked away. It had started to rain. She'd gone to the library. This much she was pretty sure was true. This much had probably actually happened. Then something happened that didn't happen. She'd sat in the library with her laptop and a stack of books and written her paper for Mr. Karras. It was a damn good paper. It was about an experimental utopian socialist community in New York State in the 19th century. The community had some praiseworthy ideals, but also some creepy sexual practices, and eventually it lost its mojo and morphed into a successful silverware company instead. She had some ideas about why the whole arrangement worked better as a silverware company than it had as an attempt to realize Christ's kingdom on earth. She was pretty sure she was right. She'd gone into the numbers, and in her experience, when you went into the numbers, you usually came out with pretty good answers. James met her at the library. He told her what had happened with the interview, which was weird enough as it was, but with the interviewer turning up dead and all. And then she'd gone home, had dinner, gone up to her room, written the rest of the paper, which took until 4 in the morning, grabbed 3 hours of sleep, got up, blew off the first 2 classes while she fixed her end notes, and went to school in time for social studies. Mischief managed. When she looked back, the whole thing had a queer, unreal feeling to it. But then again, you often get a queer, unreal feeling when you stay up till 4 and get up at 7. Things didn't start to fall apart till a week later, when she got her paper back. The problem wasn't the grade. It was a good grade. It was an A-, and Mr. K didn't give out a lot of those. The problem was... what was the problem? She read the paper again, and though it read all right, she didn't recognize everything in it. But she'd been writing fast. The thing she snagged on was the same thing Mr. K snagged on. She'd gotten a date wrong. See, the utopian community she was writing about had run afoul of a change in federal statutory rape laws, creepy, creepy, that took place in 1878. She knew that. Whereas the paper said 1881, which Mr. K would never have caught, though come to think of it, he was a pretty creepy character himself, and she wouldn't be surprised if he knew his way around a statutory rape law or two. Except Wikipedia made the same mistake. And Mr. K loved to do spot-checking to catch people relying on Wikipedia. He'd checked the date and checked Wikipedia and put a big red X in the margin of Julia's paper. and a minus after her A. He was surprised at her. He really was. Julia was surprised, too. She never used Wikipedia, partly because she knew Mr. K checked, but mostly because, unlike a lot of her fellow students, she cared about getting her facts right. She went back through the paper and checked it thoroughly. She found a second mistake, and a third. No more, but that was enough. She started checking versions of the paper because she always saved and backed up separate drafts as she went, because track changes in Word was bullshit, and she wanted to know at what point exactly the errors got in. But the really weird thing was that there were no other versions. There was only the final draft. This fact, although it was a minor fact, with multiple plausible explanations, proved to be the big red button that activated the ejector seat that blew Julia out of the cozy cockpit of her life. She sat on her bed and stared at the file, which showed a time of creation that she remembered as having been during dinner, and she felt fear. Because the more she thought about it, the more it seemed like she had two sets of memories for that afternoon, not just one. One of them was almost too plausible. It had the feel of a scene from a novel written by an earnest realist who was more concerned with presenting an amalgamation of naturalistic details that fit together plausibly than with telling a story that wouldn't bore the fuck out of the reader. It felt like a cover story. That was the one where she went to the library and met James and had dinner and wrote the paper. But the other one was batshit insane. In the other one, she'd gone to the library and done a simple search on one of the cheapo library workstations on the blonde wood tables by the circulation desk. The search had yielded a call number. The call number was odd. It put the book in the sub-basement stacks. Julia was pretty sure the library didn't have any sub-basement stacks because it didn't have a sub-basement. As if in a dream, she walked to the brushed steel elevator. Sure enough, beneath the round white plastic button marked B, there was now also a round plastic button marked SB. She pressed it. It glowed. The dropping sensation in her stomach was just an ordinary dropping sensation, the kind you get when you're descending rapidly toward a sub-basement full of cheap metal shelving and the buzz of fluorescent lights and exposed pipes with red-painted daisy wheel valve handles poking out of them at odd angles. But that's not what she saw when the elevator doors opened. Instead, she saw a sun-soaked stone terrace in back of a country house, with green gardens all around it. It wasn't actually a house, the people there explained. It was a school. It was called Breakbills, and the people who lived there were magicians. They thought she might like to be one, too. All she would have to do is pass one simple test. Chapter 5. Waking up that first morning on board the Muntjac, the only thing Quentin could compare it to was his first morning waking up at Breakbills. His cabin was long and narrow, and his bed lay along it opposite a row of windows that were only a couple of yards above the waterline. The first thing he saw was those windows, speckled with droplets and bright with sunlight reflected off the water, which they were skimming over at an unbelievable clip. Bookshelves, cabinets, and drawers had been cleverly tucked in along the walls and under the bed. It was like being inside a Chinese puzzle. He swung his bare feet down onto the wide, cold planks of his little cabin. He felt the slight pitch and the even slighter roll of the ship, and the tilt that the wind had set it at. He felt like he was in the belly of some massive but friendly marine mammal whose joy in life was to lope along the surface of the sea with him inside it. Quentin was one of those annoying people who never got seasick. He got his clothes out of the miniature dresser that was built into the wall, or the gunwale, or bulkhead, whatever you called a wall on a ship. He admired the neat rows of books on the built-in shelves above his bed, which were held in place by a narrow board so they wouldn't fall off during a storm. He wasn't especially looking forward to finding out what they were going to have for breakfast, and the less said about the bathroom the better, but other than that, he was in a state of grace. He hadn't felt this good in months. Years, maybe.
On deck, he was the only person who had nothing to do.
The crew of the Muntjac was small for a ship its size, 8 hands including the captain, and all the crew members who were visible were very seriously engaged in steering the ship and splicing ropes and scrubbing the deck and climbing up and down things. Julia was nowhere in sight, and Admiral Lacker and Benedict were discussing some navigational nicety with a degree of animation Quentin hadn't thought either one of them was capable of. Quentin supposed he would consult on weather magic, if any was required, but Julia was better at that stuff than he was, and anyway he couldn't imagine how even Julia could improve on what they had, which was a clear sky and a cold, stiff wind out of the northwest. He decided to climb up the mast. He walked over to the last and least of the Muntjac's 3 masts, swinging his arms forward and back, loosening up his shoulders. It was probably a stupid idea, but who hadn't at some point in his life wanted to climb to the top of a sailing ship in full flight? It always looked easy in movies. The mast wasn't exactly built for climbing. There weren't any rungs or steps or spikes. He put his foot on a brass cleat. The man at the helm looked at him. "Your king is climbing a mast, citizen, and no, he doesn't know how. Deal with it." It wasn't easy, but it wasn't that hard either. Where there weren't cleats or spars, there were at least ropes, though you had to be careful not to pull anything that wasn't supposed to be pulled. He skinned a knuckle, then another one, and a fat splinter stabbed straight into the soft ball of his thumb and broke off there. The mast hummed with tension. He could sense it rooted deep in the hold, taking the force of the wind and balancing it with the force of water on the keel. The thing he hadn't counted on was how cold it got, right away, like he'd climbed into another climatic zone, or maybe the lower limits of outer space. The other thing he hadn't counted on was the angle of the ship. He barely noticed it most of the time, but the farther he got from the safety of the deck, the more perilously the ship seemed to be heeling over. He had to keep reminding himself that it wasn't actually in imminent danger of rolling right over and drowning them all. Probably. By the time he got to the top, he was no longer over the deck at all. He could have dropped a plumb line straight down into the water, which rushed along below him, a torrent of rough green glass. A blunt-nosed, milky-gray shape was keeping pace with them below the surface, about 50 feet off their starboard side. It was huge, not a whale. Its tail was vertical, not horizontal. A gigantic fish, then. Or a shark. Even as he watched it, it swam deeper, growing fainter and more diffuse, until he could no longer see it at all. The higher you get, the more you realize how much bigger than you everything is. Going down was easier. Once he was safely on deck, Quentin decided to keep going the other way, down to the hold. The noise of the bright, busy outside world vanished as soon as he stepped through the dark hatch in the deck. There wasn't far to go. 3 short flights took him to the bottom of the Muntjac's hollow little world. It was warm there. He could feel the ocean pressing in on him from the other side of the damp, sweating wood. The hold was so full of supplies there was hardly room to move. It wasn't very scenic. He was making his way back to the ladder, back up to reality, or what passed for it in Fillory, when a weird, furry, upside-down face loomed out of the darkness at him. He gave a high and not very kingly bark of alarm and hit his head on something. The face hung in midair. As his eyes adjusted, he saw that the creature was hanging upside down from a crossbeam, so comfortably that it looked like it had been there its whole life. It had an alien, half-melted look. "Hello," it said.
That was one mystery solved. Their talking animal was a sloth. It was just about the ugliest mammal Quentin had ever seen.
"Hi," Quentin said. "I didn't realize you were down here."
"Nobody seems to,"
the sloth said with equanimity. "I hope you'll come visit. Often."
It took them 3 days to sail to the outer island, and every day it got hotter. They left the autumn beaches and steel waters of White Spire for a more tropical zone. They did this while traveling east instead of north or south, which was weird to the people from Earth, but none of the Fillorians seemed surprised. It made him wonder whether this world was even spherical. Benedict had never even heard of an equator. The crew changed into tropical whites. Benedict stood by Admiral Lacker's side at the helm with a book of charts that laid out the approach to the outer island, page after page crowded with technical-looking dots and blobby concentric isobars. Working together, they threaded their way through a maze of shoals and reefs that no one but they could see until the island was actually in sight. A little bump of white sand and green jungle on the horizon, with a modest peak in the middle, not so different from what he'd imagined. They rounded a point and entered a shallow bay. The moment they did, the wind dropped to nothing. The Muntjac coasted into the center of the harbor on the last of its momentum, rippling the placid green surface as it went. The sails flapped limply in the silence. It could have been a sleepy hamlet on the Côte d'Azur. The shore was a narrow, sandy strand, littered with dry seaweed and the fibrous bits that palm trees constantly shed, baking in the afternoon heat. A wharf and a few low structures stood toward one end, and one rather magnificent-looking building that might have been a hotel or a country club. Not a single person was visible. Probably they were taking a siesta. In spite of himself, Quentin felt a rising sense of anticipation. Don't be an idiot. This was an errand. They were here to collect the taxes. They lowered the launch in silence. Quentin climbed in, followed by Bingle and Benedict, who lost his sullen self-consciousness for a moment in his excitement at starting his survey. At the last minute, Julia appeared from below and slipped aboard. The sloth, slung comfortably from its beam in the hold, declined to go, though it enjoined them, before closing its drooping, shadowed eyes, to remember that if they came across any particularly succulent shoots, or even a small lizard, it was an omnivore. A long, skinny, rickety pier projected from the wharves out into the water, with an absurd little cupola at the end. They rowed for it. The bay was as smooth as a pond. Throughout this entire operation, they hadn't seen or heard a soul.
"Spooky," Quentin said out loud. "God, I hope it's not one of those Roanoke deals where the whole place is deserted."
Nobody said anything. He missed having Elliot to talk to, or even Janet. If Julia was amused or even got the reference, she didn't let on. She'd been keeping to herself since they left White Spire. She didn't want to talk to anyone or touch anyone. She kept her hands in her lap and her elbows drawn in. He scanned the shoreline through a folding telescope that he'd charmed so that it would show beings both visible and invisible, or most of them, anyway. The waterfront was genuinely, authentically deserted. If you adjusted the telescope, it had an extra dial. It ran the view a little ways backward in time, too. Nobody had visited the beach for at least an hour. The pier creaked in the stillness. The heat was murderous. Quentin thought he should go first as king, but Bingle insisted. He was taking his duties as royal bodyguard very seriously. He wasn't anywhere near as jolly as his name made him sound, though that would have been almost impossible, since his name made him sound like a clown who entertained at children's parties. The big building they'd seen earlier was made of wood and painted white, with Ionic columns out front and grand glass doors. Everything was peeling. It looked like an old southern plantation house. Bingle pushed open the door and stepped inside. Quentin pushed in right behind him. If he got nothing else out of this, he was going to get a little thrill of the unknown, however short-lived. It was pitch black inside after the glare of the afternoon, and pleasantly cool.
"Have a care, Your Highness," Bingle said.
As his eyes adjusted, Quentin saw a shabby but grandly appointed room with a desk in the center. At it sat a little girl with straight blonde hair, coloring fiercely on a piece of paper. When she saw them, she turned around and shouted up the stairs, "Mommy! There's people here!" She turned back to them. "Try not to get sand in the house." She went back to coloring. "Welcome to Fillory," she added, without looking up. The little girl's name was Eleanor. She was 5 and very adept at drawing bunny pegasi, which were like regular pegasi, except instead of horses with wings, they were rabbits with wings. Quentin wasn't clear on whether they were real or made up. You could never be totally sure about stuff like that in Fillory. Mommy was in her late 30s or thereabouts, pretty, with thin lips and a pale, untropical complexion. She descended the stairs smartly, in high heels and a vaguely official-looking jacket and skirt, and shifted Eleanor roughly out of her chair, which Eleanor accepted. She took her pictures and coloring things and ran up the stairs. "Welcome to the Kingdom of Fillory," the woman said in a throaty alto. "I am the customs agent. Please state your names and countries of origin." She opened a very official-looking ledger and held a large, purple-inked stamp at the ready. "I'm Quentin," Quentin said. "Coldwater. I'm King of Fillory." She paused, eyebrows arched, with her hand poised to stamp. She was making a good thing out of this routine, businesslike but sexy, with some nicely judged irony in there. There was something of the vamp about the customs agent. "You're the King of Fillory." "I'm a King of Fillory. There are two." She put down the stamp. In the column marked Occupation, she wrote King. "In that case, from Fillory?" "Well, yes." She made another note. "Oh, well," she sighed and closed the ledger. She didn't get to use her stamp. "There isn't much paperwork if you're from Fillory. I thought you might have come from overseas."
"Address His Highness with respect," Bingle snapped. "You're talking to the king, not some wandering fisherman."
"I know he's the king," she said.
"He said that." "Then address him as Your Highness."
"Sorry," she turned to Quentin, trying, but not very hard, to suppress her amusement. "Your Highness?" "We don't get a lot of kings here. It takes getting used to." "Well, all right," Quentin let it go. "Look, Bingle, I'll take care of guarding my dignity, thanks." Then to the customs agent, "You can still stamp my form if you want to." Bingle shot Quentin a glance to the effect of, "You have no idea how to be a king, literally none." The customs agent's name turned out to be Elaine, and once she'd satisfied herself as to their immigration status, she was a gracious host. It was usual on the outer island to have cocktails in about an hour, she explained, but before then, would they like to see something of the island? They certainly would. By all means, as long as they were here. Only they should be warned that someone would wind up carrying Eleanor on his shoulders. She was a sweet child, but easily distracted and very lazy. "She's a terrible flirt. She goes straight for the men of the party, and if she figures out you're an easy mark, you'll be carrying her around for the rest of the day." They followed Elaine through the embassy, which was what the grand building turned out to be. It was dim and surprisingly elegant, with lots of club chairs and dark wood, something like an English gentleman's club. It was hard to picture the opulent age in which all this stuff had been shipped out here and assembled. The outer island must have had a heyday. They walked out the back gate and along a cart track, hacked out of the tropical greenery. Elaine picked a tangy, sweet-sour fruit from a low-hanging branch and offered it to Quentin.
"Try this," she purred.
It had dense nests of seeds inside that one spat out into the weeds. The spicy scent of the seaside gave way to the dense green chlorophyll fug of the jungle. Here and there they passed a wrought-iron gate, painted white but rusting, with a path curving away back into the underbrush. Elaine discoursed about the various histories and scandals of the families that lived in the houses at the ends of the paths. She was handsome and had a bright, appealing manner. Though Quentin wondered why she wasn't more affectionate to her daughter, the helpful little Eleanor, it didn't jibe with her otherwise hospitable manner.
Bingle stalked ahead of them, sword out, ready to slash or grapple any malefactors who might spring out of the jungle with designs on the king's person. Quentin thought he was being a little rude, but Elaine didn't seem to notice. They stopped to admire a tropical clock tree, which took the form of a palm tree instead of an oak. Quentin asked Eleanor if she could tell time, and she said that she couldn't, and what's more, she didn't want to.
"Aren't we being a little princess for the king?" said Elaine. Benedict sketched effortfully as they walked, trying not to blot his notebook with sweat. Julia stopped to study a weed, or maybe talk to it, and they left her behind. How much trouble could she get into?
Quentin had had some half-formed idea of flirting with Elaine as a way of arousing Julia's competitive spirit, but if such a spirit dwelled within her, it remained unaroused. After a half-mile, they came to the center of town. The cart track performed a wobbly loop and rejoined itself. There was a market here, or at least some market stalls with a fishy reek, and a few discarded, trampled fruits of the kind they'd picked on the way there. At the head of the loop stood a grand official building of the town hall variety, with a stopped clock on its pediment, like a blind cyclops' eye, and a faded but still recognizable Philorian flag, hanging limp and exhausted in the damp heat. In the center of the loop stood a stone monument, a granite obelisk with a statue of a man on top. Monsoons had weathered it badly, and tropical weeds had managed to crack off a corner of the base, but you could still make out the man's heroic attitude, stoic in the face of what looked like impending misfortune.
"That is Captain Banks," Elaine said. "He founded the Philorian settlement on the outer island, by which I mean he ran his ship into it."
Quentin wondered if there was a joke to be made about founder and founder. If there was, it had probably already made the rounds of the outer island.
"Where is everybody?"
"Oh, they're around," she said. "We keep to ourselves here, mostly."
Eleanor tried Elaine and was cuffed away. She held up her arms to Quentin, and he hoisted her up onto his shoulders. Elaine rolled her eyes as if to say, "Don't say I didn't warn you." The sun was setting in an absolute bloodbath of a sunset behind the trees, and the evening insects were growing bolder. Eleanor squealed with delight at how tall Quentin was compared with her usual mount. She pulled the edge of her skirt down over his eyes. He gently lifted it up, and she squealed again and pushed it back down. It was a game. She was surprisingly strong. Quentin supposed that there were worse things to be than an easy mark. He stood there for a long moment in the tropical darkness that lay beneath the hem of Eleanor's skirt. "Here I am, noble leader of the bold expedition to the outer island, king of all I survey." This was it. There really would be no surprise twist, no big reveal. The feeling of resignation was almost pleasurable, a mellow, numbing pleasure, like the first good, stiff drink of the evening. He sighed. It wasn't an unhappy sigh, but it included the thought, "As soon as I have those taxes, I am so out of here."
"You said something before about cocktails," he said.
Dinner at the embassy was surprisingly good. A frighteningly toothy local fish served whole in a sweet preparation with some kind of mango-like local fruit. Eleanor waited on the guests with towering dignity, conveying salt shakers and glasses and other incidental items from kitchen to table with a straight back and slow, deliberate steps, toe-heel, as if she were walking a balance beam. Around 8:30, she dropped a crystal wine glass.
"For God's sake, Eleanor," Elaine said, "go to bed. No dessert, just go to bed."
The accused wept and demanded cake, but Elaine was unmoved. Afterward, they all sat on wicker couches and chairs on an upper porch and took cautious sips of some appallingly sugary local liquor. The bay was spread out in the darkness below them, with the Muntjac afloat in it, illuminated by lanterns at bow and stern and at the tops of the masts. Julia contrived a spell to keep the bugs away. Quentin asked where the bathroom was and excused himself. It was a cover story. He stopped by the kitchen, where he found what was left of the cake sitting underneath a glass dome. He cut a slice and took it up to Eleanor's bedroom. "Shh," he said, closing the door behind him. She nodded seriously, as if he were a spy delivering a wartime communique. He waited while she ate the cake, then returned the evidence, the empty plate and fork, to the kitchen. When he got back to the veranda, Elaine was alone. Julia had gone to bed. If she felt anything about him, she wasn't about to fight over him for the sake of it. His grand outing with Julia was slipping away from him. Fine if nothing happened between them. At this point, he'd be happy if he could just get her to talk to him. He was worried about her.
"I apologize about earlier," Elaine said. "Your Highness?"
"About your being king." "Forget about it." He refocused his attention on her with an effort and smiled. "I'm still getting used to it myself."
"It would have been easier if you were wearing a crown."
"I did for a while, but it was incredibly uncomfortable, and it always fell off at the most inappropriate moments."
"I can imagine.
Christenings, cavalry charges."
Under the influence of the local moonshine, he was beginning to find himself insouciantly charming. Le roi s'amuse.
"It sounds like a public nuisance."
"It was practically an enemy of the state. Now I just maintain a kingly bearing. I'm sure you noticed that."
It was difficult to make out her expression in the twilight. Mobs of exotic eastern stars were filling in the black sky overhead.
"Oh, it was unmistakable."
She began rolling a cigarette.
Were they flirting?
She had to be at least 15 years older than Quentin.
Here he was afloat in the wild, magical tropics of Fillory, and he'd stumbled on the only cougar within 477 nautical miles. He wondered who Eleanor's daddy was.
"Did you grow up here?" he asked.
"Oh, no. My parents were from the mainland, down around the southern orchard. I never knew my father.
I've been in the diplomatic service forever. This is just another posting for me. I've been all over the empire."
Quentin nodded sagely. He wasn't aware that Fillory had a diplomatic service. He'd have to look into that when he got back.
"So, do you get a lot of people coming through here? I mean, from outside Fillory? Over the sea?"
"Sadly, no. Actually, I'll tell you a terrible secret. No one has ever come through here. Not as long as I've been at the embassy. In fact, in the whole history of this office, 3 centuries of it, nobody has ever once passed through customs from across the Eastern Ocean. The records are completely blank. In that respect, I suppose you'd have to call it a bit of a sinecure."
"Well, what with there being no work and all."
"It's a shame. You should see the customs forms. They're really magnificent. The letterhead alone. You should take some. And the stamp.
I'll stamp something for you in the morning. The stamp is an absolute masterpiece." The tip of her cigarette glowed in the dimness. Quentin was reminded of the last time he'd smoked, during the brief but vigorously hedonistic period when he'd lived in New York 3 years ago. Her cigarette was sweet and fragrant. He asked for one. She had to roll it for him. He'd forgotten how. Or had he ever known? No. Elliot had a clever silver device that rolled them for you.
I hate to bring this up, Quentin said, but there's a reason why I'm here.
I thought as much. Is it that magic key business?
What?
Oh, no, it's not the magic key. She leaned back and put her feet up on a chest she used for a table.
What then?
It's about the money. The taxes. You didn't send any last year. I mean, the island didn't. She burst out laughing, a big open-mouthed laugh. She leaned back and clapped her hands together once.
They sent you? They sent the king?
They didn't send me. I'm the king. I sent myself.
Right.
She dabbed at her eyes with the heels of her hands.
You're a bit of a micromanager, aren't you?
Well, I suppose you're wondering where the money is. We should have sent it. We could have. No one's in any danger of starving on the outer island. Tomorrow I'll take you out to see the gold beetles. They're amazing. They eat dirt and poop out gold ore. Their nests are made of gold. She kicked the chest their feet were resting on. Take this. It's full of gold. I'll throw in the chest for free.
Great, Quentin said. Thanks, it's a deal.
Mission accomplished. He took a drag on the cigarette and stifled a cough. It had been a very brief phase, his smoking period. Maybe he'd had too much of whatever this was.
Rum?
It was sweet, and they were on a tropical island, so let's call it rum.
We hadn't heard from you for years. There didn't seem to be any point. I mean, what do you actually do with the stuff?
Quentin could have answered that, but even he had to admit that the answer wouldn't have been a very good one. Probably they used it to re-gild Elliot's scepter, taxation without representation. She could start a revolution. She was right. It was also unreal.
Anyway, look what happened. They sent us a king. I think we might be forgiven for feeling a little pleased with ourselves.
But why are you really here?
Don't tell me that's the whole reason. It's too disappointing. Are you on a quest?
I'm afraid I am going to disappoint you. I'm not on a quest.
I was sure you were looking for the magic key, she said, the one that winds up the world.
It was hard to tell when she was joking.
To be honest, Elaine, I don't really know much about the key. I guess there's a story about it. Do you get a lot of people looking for it?
No. But it's just about our only claim to fame, aside from the Beatles.
A vast orange moon was rising, as orange as their cigarette tips. It was a crescent moon, hanging so low it looked like it could snag a horn on the Muntjac's rigging.
Fillory's moon was actually crescent-shaped, not round.
Once a day, exactly at noon, it passed between Fillory and the sun, making an eclipse. The birds all went quiet when it happened. It still seemed to take them by surprise. Quentin was so used to it he hardly noticed it anymore.
"It's not here, anyway," she said.
"I figured that."
Quentin poured himself more rum from a decanter. Not that he needed it, but who cared? He wondered if they'd solved the mystery of Jollibee's death yet.
"It's on after, the next island, farther out."
"Sorry," he said, "I'm not following. What's where?"
"There's an island farther out from here, called After. 2 days' sail, maybe three. I've never been there, but that's where the key is."
"The key? You must be joking."
"Am I laughing?"
Was she?
She gave him a funny half-smile.
"I'm thinking this is a metaphorical key, the key to life. It's a piece of paper that says, haste makes waste, or early to bed, early to rise."
"No, Quentin. It's a real key.
made of gold, teeth and everything. Very magical.
Or that's what people say.
Quentin stared at the bottom of his glass. He needed to be thinking now, but he'd taken steps to disable his thinking apparatus. Too late. Haste makes waste.
"Who makes a key out of gold?" he said. "It makes no sense. It would be too soft. It would get bent all the time."
"You'd certainly have to be careful where you stuck it."
Quentin's face felt hot. Thank God the night was cooling off, finally, and a night wind was rising in the trees around the embassy.
"So there's a magic golden key a couple of days' sail away from here. Why haven't you gone and gotten it yourself?"
"I don't know, Quentin. Maybe I haven't got any magic locks. It never occurred to me that the key might be real."
It was tempting. It was more than that. It was a big, buzzing neon sign in the darkness that read Adventureland. He could feel the pull of it from out over the horizon. The outer island was a bust, a red herring. But that just meant he hadn't gone far enough.
Elaine sat forward on the couch, looking more sober and cogent than he felt. Probably she was used to this rum stuff. He wondered what it might be like to kiss her. He wondered what it might be like to get into bed with her. They were all alone on a sweaty tropical night. The moon was up. Though if he'd been serious about that, he probably should have stopped drinking a little sooner. And now that he did think about it, he wasn't entirely sure that he wanted to kiss those thin, smiling lips.
"Will you let me tell you something, Quentin?" she said. "I would think very hard about whether you want to look for the key. This island is a pretty safe place as islands go, but it's the jumping-off point. This is the end of Fillory, Quentin. Out there..."
She pointed out to sea past the Muntjac's cozy hurricane lamps, past the faint black-on-blue outlines of the palm trees on the rim of the bay where the hushing of distant breakers came from.
"That's not Fillory. Your kingdom ends here. Here you're a king. You're all-powerful. You're not king of any of that. Out there, you're just Quentin. Are you sure that's going to be enough?"
When she said it, he saw what she meant. They were on the very rim of something, the lip, the edge of that meadow in the forest where Jollibee died, the sill of his office window when Elliot and the others had come to fetch him on Earth. Here he was powerful. There he didn't know what he was.
"Of course I'm not sure," he said. "That's why you go. To find out if it's enough. You just have to be sure you want to find out."
"Yes, you do, Your Highness," Elaine said. "Yes, you do."
Quentin was the last one to bed that night, and the last one up in the morning. His sense of time had gotten pleasantly elastic in Fillory, since he wasn't constantly being assaulted with blinking digital clocks here, the way he was in the real world. But it was late enough that the sun was already scorching, late enough for him to feel the shame that comes with hearing other people going about their business while he was still weakly tangled up in his sweaty sheets. His room was airy and equatorial, with cool white linen and flung-open windows, and it was still suffocatingly hot. The rum, which had seemed so delightful the night before, so absolutely good and necessary, had now revealed its true nature as a hideous toxin, a dryer of mouths and a ravager of brains. He cursed the earlier incarnation of himself that drank so much of it. Then he got up and went in search of water. There was plenty of it around. Probably there was a beautiful songbird somewhere around here that puked gallons of sparkling spring water every morning to go with the gold beetles. He ran himself a cool bath and sat in it and sipped more water till his head felt better. You can't feel fresher and cleaner than when you're soaking in fresh water within sight of the ocean. Most of the night before was blotted out, or available to his memory only in the form of mental security camera footage, grainy figures with blurred voices. But one thing remained bright and clear and high definition. The golden key. She'd said it was real. He wondered what the magic was. He wondered what it opened. Had she told him, and he'd forgotten? No, that didn't sound right. But she'd told him where it was. After Island. He needed to know more. They had a choice to make, go on or go home. But by the time he came down for breakfast, Elaine was already gone. She'd left a note reminding him to take the chest with him, the one with the taxes in it, and wishing him well. She also left him a slender, gray book called The Seven Golden Keys. She didn't say where she'd gone. I guess she won't be showing me those gold beetles after all, he thought. Or her fancy stamp. Thank God he hadn't made a pass at her. Elaine had left behind her daughter, too. Eleanor was back at her mother's desk, just as they'd found her when they arrived, industriously documenting the habits of the bunny Pegasus in bright primary-colored pencils on official Outer Island Embassy stationery. There seemed to be an unlimited supply of it. Quentin looked over her shoulder. The letterhead really was nice. "Good morning, Eleanor. Do you know where your mom went?" Quentin hadn't spent a lot of time with little kids in his life. He mostly fell back on treating them like adults. Eleanor didn't seem to mind. "No," she said lightly. She didn't look up or stop coloring. "Do you know when she's coming back?" She shook her head. What kind of mother would leave a 5-year-old to take care of herself? Quentin felt sorry for Eleanor. She was a sweet, earnest little girl. She made him feel paternal, which wasn't a feeling he had much experience with, but he was finding that he liked it. She obviously didn't get much attention, and what she got wasn't exactly dripping with maternal affection. "All right. We have to go soon, but we'll wait till she gets back."
"You don't have to."
"Well, we sort of do. Are you still drawing bunny Pegasi?"
"Yes."
"You know, I think they might be hare Pegasi, not bunnies. Hares are bigger and much fiercer."
"They're bunnies."
The eternal question. Eleanor changed the subject. "I made these for you." With some effort, she pulled open a desk drawer. The humidity made it stick. And when it came unstuck, it pulled out all the way and fell on the floor. She rummaged in it and took out some papers, 4 or 5 of them, and handed them to Quentin. They were heavily scribbled over in colored pencil.
"They're passports," she said, anticipating his question. "You need them if you want to leave Fillory."
"Who said I'm leaving Fillory?"
"You need them if you're leaving Fillory," she said. "If you're not, you don't need them. They're just in case."
And then, more quietly, "You have to fold them in half yourself." She must have been copying them from something official, because they were in their own way impressive documents. They had the Fillorian arms on the front, or a crude facsimile thereof. Inside Quentin's, once you folded it in half, there was a picture of Quentin, more or less, with a big red smile and a golden crown on his head, and some squiggly lines representing writing. On the back were the arms of the outer island, a palm tree and a butterfly. She'd made one for each of them, even the sloth, whom she had never seen but had been extremely interested in. She must be bored stiff without any other kids around, Quentin thought. She must be practically raising herself. He could relate. He was an only child, too. And his parents had never paid much attention to him either. They considered their attitude toward parenting to be rather enlightened. They weren't going to be the kind of couple whose lives revolved around their child. They gave him a lot of freedom and never asked him for much. Though the funny thing about never being asked for anything is that after a while you start to feel like maybe you don't have anything worth giving.
"Thank you, Eleanor. That was very, very sweet of you." He bent down and kissed her on her blonde crown.
"It's because you brought me cake," she said shyly.
"I know." Poor Moppet. Maybe when he got back to Whitespire he could start up some Filorian equivalent of child social services.
"We'll wait till your mom comes back before we go."
"You don't have to."
But he did. Or he waited as long as possible. They spent the day lounging around the embassy and fishing off the dock. He made another attempt to teach Eleanor to read the palm clock tree, and was again rebuffed. Around 4 o'clock, Quentin called it. He had Benedict take Eleanor into town, over her strident objections, to find somebody responsible to leave her with, and ordered everybody else back on the freshly watered and provisioned Muntjac. Benedict returned an hour later, haggard but victorious. They weighed anchor as the first stars appeared. Playtime was over. They set sail for Castle Whitespire. Chapter 6 A funny thing happened to Julia after that business with her fake social studies paper. A magic trick, you might even call it. Where once there had been only one Julia, there were now two Julias, one for each set of memories. The Julia that went with the first set, the normal set, the one where she wrote the paper and went home and had dinner, did normal Julia things. She went to school, she did her homework, she played the oboe. She finally slept with James, which she'd kind of been meaning to do anyway, but for some reason had been putting off. But there was a second, stranger Julia, growing inside the first Julia, like a parasite or a horrible tumor. At first it was tiny, the size of a bacterium, a single cell of doubt, but it divided and grew. This second Julia wasn't interested in school, or the oboe, or even James particularly. James backed up the first Julia's story. He remembered meeting her in the library. But what did that prove? Nothing. It just proved that in addition to writing her paper on intentional communities for her, they'd gotten to James. And James bought the story, heart and soul. There was only one James. The problem was that Julia was smart, and Julia was interested in the truth. She didn't like inconsistencies, and she didn't let go until they were resolved, ever. When she was 5, she'd wanted to know why Goofy could talk and Pluto couldn't. How could one dog have another dog for a pet, and one be sentient and the other not? Likewise, she wanted to know who the lazy fucker was who wrote her paper on intentional communities for her and used Wikipedia as a source. Granted that the answer, "the nefarious agents of a secret school for wizards in upstate New York," was not a league-leadingly plausible answer to her question. But it was the answer that fit her memories, and those memories were getting sharper all the time. And as they got sharper, the second Julia grew stronger and stronger, and every bit of strength she gained, she took away from the first Julia, who got weaker and weaker and thinner, to the point where she was practically transparent, and the parasite behind the mask of her face became almost visible. The funny thing, or rather one of the many funny things in this ha-ha hilarious story, was that nobody noticed. Nobody noticed that she had less and less to say to James, or that with 3 weeks to go before the holiday concert, she lost first chair in the oboe section of the wolfishly competitive Manhattan Conservatory Extension School Youth Orchestra, thereby forfeiting the juicy solo in Peter and the Wolf, the Ducks theme, to the demonstrably inferior Evelyn O, whose rendition of it did, appropriately enough, sound like a quacking fucking duck, as did everything that came out of Evelyn O's quacking fucking oboe. The second Julia just wasn't that interested in James, or in playing the oboe, or in school. So uninterested in school was she that she did something really stupid, which was to pretend she'd applied to college, when really she hadn't.
she blew off every single one of her applications. Nobody noticed that either. But they'd notice in April, when brilliant, overachieving Julia got into zero colleges.